This show was brought to you by Ouch My Ego. OuchMyEgo.com.
Hello, John.
How's it? Oh, no, I can't do that again.
Yeah.
What up?
No.
What's crack-a-lackin'?
No, it's fine, but how's it? No!
What it be,
No.
Yo?
It's all right to be predictable. It's okay.
Call me out on it and then say, I just do it anyway.
It's just that I'm noticing things. That's
true.
All.
True, Dad.
So, question.
Yes.
What did we just watch?
We watched Hellmouth.
They tell me I got 2 years left. Then my brain will be so dry and brittle, it'll break.
You believe in ghosts, Baker?
No, Mr. Winnie, I don't. They're cold on the ground out there. I should know.
You will take this post, or we fire you today, and you lose the whole kit and caboodle.
I must be dreaming.
I'm here, Charlie.
Is it day or is it night?
Where are you? Disneyland.
Let's lay low. Then when the Seamus comes out, we try Gulcho.
Did you say that's true to your story? Hard to swallow?
I'd say that's it exactly. You're in for a big surprise.
So, John, tell us about Hellmouth. Well, not all about it.
Just enough to get you a basic idea.
Yeah. Let's get that out of you.
Hellmouth is this 50s B-movie kind of throwback in which a gravekeeper played by Stephen McHattie. Our friend Stephen McHattie is just a couple of days away from retirement and ends up kind of getting blackmailed into having to work at another cemetery by his boss.
Now, the blackmail isn't, like, lascivious anything. It's just holding his pension over his head. If he doesn't do the job that they want him to do, he'll be canned without any pay.
Yeah, and he's about to retire. He only has 2 years left to live, according to his doctors. So he needs this money. So he's forced into what he is believed to be a six-month stay at this place called the Forks of Heaven Cemetery. And as he goes there, strange things happen. Almost otherworldly.
Well,
he meets this...
Yeah, I would say the entire film is otherworldly, but we'll get into that. So he meets this lady walking on the side of the road.
This woman named Faye, they have a connection.
Immediately.
But before he gets into the cemetery, she kind of freaks out and leaves.
Can't go back there, whatever that means.
And before he has made this trip, he was given a box by his boss that has a key, a map, and a little note that says, make sure you keep the contents of this box within 10 feet of you.
Yeah, whatever that means and why.
Not ominous.
Why does 10 feet...
Not ominous at all, right?
10 feet means what? That box wasn't 10 feet near him before. Why now?
No.
And also, it's an old box with an old note. The note is really ragged, so...
So, once he gets there, he discovers why the thing should be near him. Because the earth starts to crack open and... It seems like hell is underneath this cemetery. Things start falling apart. It's madness. Until he gets within the distance of that, and then everything is all right.
Now, there are three other characters that show up. Well, four characters. The one guy that tells him that he has to do the job or
Here's
else.
Here's the thing, Charlie. We got a guy up at Forks of Heaven. He's gone AWOL on us. No one knows where he is, and there's nobody waiting in the wings. So it has to be you. It's just a six-month stint.
No.
He's a Canadian actor that we've seen in tons and tons of sci-fi movie specials and whatever. And he was also in Dawn of the Dead.
Pontypool.
The other three characters, two of them are escaped convicts.
What are you going to do, Harry? Don't be a character, Tibbs.
And one is a sheriff.
It's Sheriff Cliff Ryan. Open the door, Jasper.
Yes, the sheriff who is just insane, it seems. Just as insane as other cursory characters that we meet along the way in a story that he tells.
Yeah, this movie is a digital backlog film.
Yes.
It is likened to, visually, I would say, Sin City.
Definitely. You have,
but there is something off about it.
Well, it's predominantly black and white, splashes of colors here and there, but I'm not sure exactly how much of this is actually digital backlog and actual practical, because there are moments...
Well, the rooms that they're in, whenever they're in rooms, those are sets.
Yeah, well, there's also a couple of driving scenes that I'm pretty certain are actual just a car on a road being driven.
Hmm.
Then it'll go to something that's very obviously digital backlot, but you'll get a few moments where I'm pretty certain that they actually did shoot real stuff, again, aside from the sets.
I know he's got dirty ground. That's true. True dirty ground that he walks upon in a couple of scenes, but everything from the gravestones to the trees to the monsters. Oh boy, I got things to say.
Yeah, there are monsters.
Are digital. I would say 80 to 90% of what we see on screen at any given time, except for the interior scenes, is digital. I did try to find some information about that. There's a Chinese company, and I forget what they're called. They did a lot of the digital work on it, but I couldn't find anything on their website about it. And there is an artist who did the creature creations, and I think the most solid work that he did was actually the gravestones and the creatures. I don't want to poop on any specific artist's work, and there's only one guy behind the monster designs and stuff in this movie. But I do have to say that I'm not satisfied.
Yeah, I wasn't. I looked at the creatures and just kind of went, you know, jumping ahead a little bit, there's a point where he's on a barge going down to hell, or at least the underworld, maybe not necessarily hell, even though hell is thrown around a lot in this film.
Yeah.
Going to the underworld, and there's a Charon-like boatman.
Yeah, the River Styx sort of thing.
Yeah, and then you have, it's calling out to these little creatures that, I mean, of all the creatures in the thing, I'm just looking at it going, wow, those look horrible. I mean,
wow, those look like they are references to a few things that we've seen, from Golem to Galaxy Quest.
Oh, yes, little yes.
Rock biter, little ankle biter characters. They seem reminiscent of that, but badly designed.
Well, they...
Again, I know people are behind these things. A lot of the movie does actually kind of look good. And then there are moments that look just not right. And a lot of that has to do with the creature effect.
Because, yeah, you also have, like, that weird bird crow demon at one point.
Right, like Horus. We just talked about a digital backlot thing with a character named Horus, which also had some wonky character designs, even though it came from Inky Bilal, who's a good illustrator. This thing pops up out of the ground at one point, and it's huge. It's enormous. It looks like Horus, but designed by a 14-year-old.
Yeah, and there's, like, little gargoyles.
Yeah.
Gargoyle monsters. Again, also with a golem kind of head.
Yeah, so I'm not going to say, well, greatest designs, character designs. In fact, I'm kind of saying the opposite. It did remind me of the sci-fi original picture. Now, the movie was partially Indiegogo'd.
Yeah.
So I would say a lot of that had to do with who they could afford. And I hope, honestly, I hope the dude, I don't want to say his name, I hope this is just a step into his career of being a really good designer. And I know you've got to start somewhere, and you start usually somewhere lame, and hopefully he gets better. So I don't want to be a total jerk about it.
No, and that's understandable. It's, you're right, everyone starts somewhere. You know, not sit there going, you made bad creatures, you should feel bad, or something like that. No.
Yeah. Cameron started in Corman movies, and Corman movies are not good. No matter how much we love them, Corman movies are bad. Even the good ones are bad.
Especially, you know, you go Cameron. Yeah, it's, you know.
He did a lot of work on that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
Joe Dante. Jonathan Demme. He started there with Caged Heat, I think, or something like that.
Pretty much
every... A Woman in Prison movie.
So many notable directors and talents came from the world of Corman.
You know, Spielberg didn't. He sidestepped them.
Yeah, but that was also...
Spielberg and Lucas sidestepped them. That's interesting.
Yeah. Although, in a way, they were kind of just... I don't want to say after that, but kind of within that, where you had a chance to kind of go find the side route in, as opposed to taking your lumps with Corman.
Yeah, so like De Palma and Coppola were part of that. Jack Nicholson, I guess, if you consider him a director. They were part of that, and there was a whole bunch of other guys that were part of it, but at the same time, in like concurrent in time, but a little bit, let's say it starts in a 10-year period. Spielberg and Lucas came at like the 7th year type of thing. So I get what you're saying. Ron Howard even started with Corman. So that digression is just simply to say, if you're listening, dude, I'm not really trying to kick you. You started where you start. I hope you're doing well, and I hope you're doing better than where you started.
And to be honest,
that's all.
you know, I actually kind of like this movie, and so it's...
Okay,
yeah,
you do.
And I'll get into this when we get later on into it, why I like this, because there's a lot about it that didn't sell me up until a certain point.
Okay.
And it's like, yeah, if I'm saying anything that sounds bad, I am kind of saying it out of a slight position of love.
You know? Constructive criticism.
So, you know, yeah, it's constructive criticism. I want to see everybody succeed. Seeing people fail sucks. We never want anything to just flat out fail.
Right. No. Well, yes, I want Jeepers Creepers 3 to fail. I do. I don't want there to be a Jeepers Creepers 3. I don't want there to be a career for that man. So, that. I'm being honest. There are some crimes that you can do that are very difficult to have no consequences for after you've served time in prison for. You should still be paying consequences for your crime, regardless of time served. And that's what's happening with Jeepers Creepers 3.
Yeah.
If you don't know what I'm talking about, look it up. I don't want to...
Oh, I know what you're talking about. I know the...
Yeah,
the
I'm
the
talking
guy.
To the audience here. I know you know. So, yeah, look it up. I don't want to get too deep in. I want everybody to succeed in this, and that's why this movie kind of disappointed me, because I was really looking forward to it. And I love Stephen McHattie, and I like Tony Burgess. You had briefly mentioned Pontypool.
Yeah.
That is what they worked on before. Actually, everybody in Pontypool, the major players, the director, the writer, the star, had a part in this movie. Cameo appearance by the director as the guy pushing the lawnmower.
I'm coming! I'm coming for you! I'm coming home!
That's Bruce McDonald.
Okay.
The director of Pontypool. I love Pontypool. It's one of my favorite zombie movies. In fact, it's probably my favorite zombie movie.
It is an amazing zombie film.
It's so different than any kind of zombie movie that even the best zombie movies are just zombie movies. Including Shaun of the Dead, which is brilliant. Pontypool is so much different and weirder, and not weird in the way that we usually talk about here. So, and we're not talking about it on here. We've already done that on the other podcast, Vincent Price's Laugh. So,
plug,
go
plug,
over
plug,
there
plug.
If you want to hear about Pontypool. But those guys had creative things to do with Pontypool, one of the greatest movies I've ever seen, and then they do Hellmouth, which is hampered, I think, by a limited budget.
That, yeah, I will agree. I'll agree with you 100% on that, is that the budget does not fit the vision.
And the writing. Tony Burgess wrote Pontypool, Hellmouth, a movie called Septic Man, which we might cover. I'm not sure, but I wonder if he's just like a... I know he's a novelist, and I know that he's a writer in film now, but I wonder if he's got his one amazing, and the rest is just living. Because this doesn't seem like it's the same kind of voice, you know what I mean?
Oh yeah, and part of it is, if you're doing something that's a throwback to these sorts of things, it...
But what is it a throwback to?
Well, it's like 50s B-movies, so you have kind of like the weird stilted dialogue that you would hear in something that would be parodied on, like, Mystery Science Theater 3000. For the most part, like, when you start off, it's very much existing within those kind of parameters. And then once
Can
you get...
Can you give me examples of, not the dialogue, but of movies that might seem like this from the 50s? Because I can't think of any.
Well, although I will say this, what it really makes me think of is, honestly, is Night of the Living Dead, which isn't a 50s film.
Okay, that's 1960s, but, yeah, sure.
But there's very much, but kind of an evocative of that sort of stylistic thing. So, I mean, in a way, some of the ways it's shot, it kind of might be like It Came from Outer Space, or Bug-Eyed Monster kind of movies and
All
stuff.
Right, I'm going to skip ahead to the early 90s. Did you see Cemetery Man, Dell'Amore Dell'Amorte?
Yeah, there's a little bit of that in this, where you kind of...
That seems more like, conceptually,
yeah.
Only in concept, more like this.
That's...
And that's 1994, that's not... And that's Italian 1994.
Although that...
And that's not 50s.
The trailer...
So I don't get the whole throwback.
I'll say, the trailer gives me more of a thought of the of Cemetery Man than the actual film does, though.
Okay, yeah.
Because that's kind of really what I was, when I was picturing in my head after I saw the trailer and right before I watched the film, was going, okay, this is going to be kind of Cemetery Man, but with a Sin City filter.
Yeah, that's what the trailer showed me, too, so I was really excited. I love Cemetery Man.
And it's, yeah, it's not that. But you gotta...
We might have to watch Cemetery Man. I might have to watch it with somebody else and not you, since you're so familiar with it.
Yeah.
Sorry, John.
Well, that's okay. You can also do it as a double feature with Dylan Dog.
So you still kind of can't find an example for me of the 50s thing that it really feels like, or that they're referencing, like off the top of your head?
Like I said, the closest thing I could think of is It Came from Outer Space, and
yeah, so no, not yeah, really. It's like maybe Plan 9 from Outer Space.
Yeah, but it,
but I, yeah, I just can't think of,
yeah, there's something about it that makes me think it. That's the long and short of my thought.
I know, I mean, this is their own advert. It even says it's a 50s throwback, a throwback to genre films of the 50s, Hellmouth is, etc. That's what they say about the film themselves, and I'm just like, is it though? Is it?
I mean, I guess Creature from the Black Lagoon, there's a little bit of that kind of going off in this film. Them.
Are you just talking visually though? What are you talking?
Kind of, in a sense, like the visual style of the earlier scene. Kind of have this, I'd want to say stilted camera, but how they're framing the shots and stuff just remind me of things like that.
So you're saying just visually they're taking visual cues
from
50s movies and putting it into
a more modern filter.
Noir type of story. Yeah, okay.
Although one thing that definitely is not from that is, and I don't know if you agree with me or not, but isn't the Forks of Heaven Cemetery the most evil looking place ever?
Ever? I don't know. I mean, Danvers Institute for Sanitarium in Session 9 was pretty evil looking. That was like tangible evil. That was real evil.
But yeah.
Yeah.
That was real. This is artificial, but it's just like, you got the guy driving through here, and all of a sudden there's these skeleton statues, then there's these guys on spikes, you know, pillars with people.
No, like, that looks like a Halloween thing. Yes, it looks like a...
Yeah, it's like the backyard to the Addams Family house. As opposed to...
Tailored for Halloween haunts. Those things... hay rides and whatever you go through, and they have people with chainsaws running out and scaring you, and now they have paintball guns that you can sit on the back of a hay ride. But through sepia and black and white.
But yeah, it's looking at this thing going, well, no wonder all these other caretakers have gone insane and killed themselves.
Being around such dark imagery all the time.
Yeah. Now, I guess the big question would be, since I seem to have the positive opinion on it, what is it about this film that didn't work for you?
Well, I think the pacing has a problem. There's a lot of, when is this going to pick up? And so that has to do with editing. So story editing, even, like, because in the story, do they even write down, like, so we have like a 5-minute lag in the story right here on the shooting script? I don't think things work that way. So I think it's all in post. The tightening up needed to be tighter just to get it going even faster. I'm a busy man. I got things to do. The other stuff about it is I love Stephen McCaddy, and I want him to... Maybe he's just tired. He's an old man now, and I want him to be a bit more perfect. And I'm spoiled by Pontypool because he's perfect.
Yeah, I'll say he, especially at the end, it definitely kind of seemed a little tired in the story, but...
Well, he does dual characters in the story,
yeah,
too.
And that's kind of actually what I'm talking about is his other role, the demon called the Barda.
I am known as the Barda. Do you know what people are, Charlie? They are things stuck in a place. Do you know what people do? They make noises.
The special effects, I already said, were kind of wonky at certain times. I didn't like that everybody was on treadmill when they're walking around. Well, I don't mind that they're on treadmills, but nothing of their movement seemed, when the camera's locked on them as they're walking, it didn't seem any kind of natural background moving and stuff.
Yeah, that's very odd. I mean, you've got, I think the thing that really bugged me really was the prisoner characters. Two guys who escaped from prison, and...
One of those was Tony Burgess, the man with the beard.
Yeah, they don't bring anything to the story. Everything that was essentially going to happen that they're involved in just kind of happens, so they didn't have to exist and then get taken away from us as quickly as they were.
Well, they're there so that the policeman can show up to the shack and talk to our groundskeeper. And the groundskeeper, Charlie, is... sitting there, kind of annoyed that he has to do this job, and the sheriff shows up, and I don't necessarily think this guy is a very good actor. He's a younger man, and maybe he's a great actor, and maybe he's just playing it differently, but I didn't exactly like how he played it.
Yeah.
But he ends up telling Charlie about
the previous groundskeepers.
So tell the audience about those groundskeepers, John.
Well, as I kind of said earlier, they all go crazy. The first one starts talking to all the tombstones and eventually just buries himself alive. A couple basically go crazy. A woman is cradling dead children and husband kills her and then hangs himself. One guy, he's a creative type, builds a demonic contraption that crushes him.
A big bear trap.
And spikes him.
A bear trap that eats him, basically. It's like a big Saw thing from the movie Saw.
Yeah, and then
the last one is actually Jasper. The guy you're replacing.
And because he's missing, this guy's not only looking for these things, but always seems to be checking up on these people anyway. So the prisoners, really, they could be, you could take that entire section out and just be, okay, is Jasper still here? Is he dead? Is there someone new? Okay, there's someone new. All right, well, let's tell him.
But John, you need two characters to be
eaten by a giant demon?
Ripped into pieces. Yeah, by a giant demon. So that's what you need.
Well, that's okay. They say there's a war that's going to happen once they open this thing, and we never see a war.
You never see it. You see some demons. You see the bird demon, which doesn't do anything other than that.
Yeah.
And you see the oddly knobbed headed, big bellied demon. That's the one with the tongue that grabs the two convicts and rips them to pieces.
But yeah.
And that's that. Like, nothing more comes of it.
No, because it's all kind of Orpheus and Eurydice feeling stuff once you get to that point, because the entire reason for opening this chest and all that stuff is to save the soul of
Faye,
yeah,
the woman that he picked up. And they actually have a love affair, like, rather quickly, and proclaim love for each other, and then she is spirited away somehow. She
just disappears, yeah. And when the cop is there, she kind of takes possession of him briefly and, you know, gives him the information.
Speaks through the cop.
I love you, Charlie. Now listen to me, Charlie, and listen careful. I'm not alone in here, and it's not a lot of time. The key is the trunk beside the bed. The key you hold.
But the cop is really ghoulified at this point. This is another thing. I would have liked it, really liked it, to have been makeup.
But yeah, it's all CG stuff.
But CG-affected cop tells him all this stuff about you better do this. And instead of just being like, hurry up and do it, she becomes belligerent and cruel,
yeah,
and perverted even, which I don't understand.
Well, that I think because you have that thing where he has to keep the key next to him, and you have that being telling him to put it in the trunk and lock it wasn't her speaking. That probably was the Barda using her voice.
Well, maybe it was the Barda in the first place, acting like her, and then when Charlie's hesitant about putting this stuff in the box, he becomes belligerent as her possessing the cop. Is that what you think?
Well, I definitely think that the second time around, it's definitely not Faye. The first time, it kind of seems like her, but where one of the biggest flaws in this film is, you know, you're saying there's a lot of issues with the story beats. There's a lot of stuff that feels like it's been cut out. Like, explanations for why he is having to go down to the underworld. Why, you know, not necessarily that he's trying to rescue her, but kind of, what's this war? What's the reasons for all this?
Right.
You're just kind of, 'cause there's, like, no real reason for any of this to be happening. We're just kind of...
So this is why I'm, like, frustrated with this film.
Now,
I don't know what the points really is, other than, like, it's a bedtime tale that you improvise telling your kid. It seems like something like that. You actually haven't fleshed out the motivations in anything, like, true motivations of anything.
Well, basically, what this film is about the path to self-actualization.
Okay.
It basically follows Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs, where people kind of portray this thing as a pyramid, where the base is your physiological needs, then you go to safety, love and belonging, and then esteem. And once all these needs are met, you become self-actualized. Basically, like, physiological,
okay,
the basic physical needs for survival. He's dying. He's got this horrible disease that drying up his brain fluid and all that stuff. And as he's on this path to the thing, he's picked up Faye, all of a sudden, he's able to see. He's no longer having to wear glasses. So this physical need...
Yeah. And his brain gets fluid, and it doesn't knock around inside his skull
anymore.
Yeah,
he's starting to... His physiological needs are now being met. He's no longer thinking of death anymore. Like, the next thing, safety, is demonstrated when he arrives and Faye's gone. He puts the key down, just the box in general, and he goes outside to examine the grounds. And then all of a sudden, everything starts falling away. He's hell underneath and all that stuff, fire and all that. He goes back inside near the key and looks out, and everything's back to normal. So when he takes the key with him to the underworld, he's got his security with him. He knows that he's safe as long as he has this thing.
All right.
The next step, love and belonging, his intimate relationship with Faye. He's been a person who's been in solitude for so long, away from all these people. And now he's got this woman who loves him and he loves her and yada, yada, yada. He has a sense of belonging with this woman. So then once he gets down there, he's confronting the demon. And around this time in the film, before we get to the end, I'm just kind of going, what the hell's going on? This guy makes it there because he doesn't believe what's happened. What the hell are you talking about? And he basically says to the demon that, he doesn't believe what's necessarily happening to him. He doesn't believe in the demon, but he believes in himself.
Yeah.
So he's getting his self-confidence.
But what does it mean that they chose to have Stephen McHattie play both Charlie and the demon?
Well, if you look at the demon is sickly looking. It says that it's accepted its position. It basically just, it exists. It doesn't, it's
plug,
not trying to be.
For some reason, it's a plug in a bathtub, and that bathtub is hell. Whatever that means.
Yeah, it just basically, it's there. It has a basic purpose, and that's it. And it just trudges along in monotony and, you know, sad and alone and angry. And this little thing that that just doesn't have any...
Now, is that just symbolic of his old self?
Yeah, it's just he's a bitter, old, angry, dying man. And now he's found love. He's gotten better. He's all of a sudden, all these better things have happened to him. And he actually thinks that he's worth something, not just, I'm going to die in Florida.
Okay, so, yeah, he desperately wanted to go to Florida. So there's this study that was done. It's a horrible study, but the knowledge that we gained from it is beneficial. The study was done where a baby is born, immediately taken away from the mother. The baby languishes and possibly even dies. But you give a baby back to its mother, and the baby thrives. Needs that human contact, needs the sustenance, all that stuff that the mother can provide, needs it. Now, a man alone, solitary, without human contact, as Charlie apparently was, where he was ostracized by society just by being the caretaker of a cemetery.
Like the kids in the beginning of the film are throwing things out, or they spray paint Die Geezer.
Two separate groups of kids. I don't know if you noticed it. A boy and a girl and another boy and a girl, but they were different actors. And they just run up and pester him. And don't make him feel very well. So there is some resentment that he has towards outward society, in particular youth, which he isn't. So he doesn't have any love. He's wasting away. So this is very interesting that you bring this up.
Yeah, because that's kind of when I have that realization, and it's literally in the last few minutes of the film where I'm like, wait a minute, is this okay? And then my mind rewinds the entire film and I'm like, okay, all this stuff actually has some points, except for all the stuff that doesn't have a point. All the extraneous characters.
There's a meaningful story wrapped up inside of this package, which is supposed to appeal to lovers of B-movie schlock, right?
Yeah. And in a way, isn't that what, and granted, this isn't science fiction, but isn't that what good science fiction is supposed to do? It's supposed to have some sort of core thought, and then portray it in a way that is, you, once you realize what the quote-unquote message is, you go, oh, okay, that's what they did. That is clever.
Yeah, but don't you think that a lot of the stuff surrounding it, the packaging of this, is to the detriment of the story, the core story?
A bit. And that's kind of where I say the budget doesn't necessarily fit the scope. They really wanted this thing to be in some way, like maybe like an old Greek fable or something like that. But yeah, it just, you kind of have things where I don't know why you have these demons eating prisoners. I don't know why you have this. All this stuff doesn't service the story as much, but
it only services like body count that you need for this type of story.
Yeah.
And because it's a horror movie or whatever.
But I was kind of ready just to write this thing off as like, it looks okay and I like the main actor in it. It'd be one of those neither here nor there, and now it's a little bit more like, you know what? It's not great, but I have more of a reaction to it than meh.
Okay, yeah, I didn't have a meh, I had a head scratch, because sometimes I just watch a movie. And if that movie isn't super clear with what it's trying to tell me, I just don't bother really trying to apply my brain to it.
Yeah, I do wish that
And that's what it was with this.
I do wish this spent a little bit more time leaning heavier into the psychological allegory than trying to have demons and dead statues on spikes and stuff. You know?
Yeah. So my guess is that you recommend this.
I do recommend it, but I'm a hesitant recommender on this. It's definitely something where if you are willing to, how should I put this? Willing to risk a head scratcher, go for it.
And then come back and listen to this episode, then you'll be like, oh, okay, I get some of it now.
Oh, that's what he got out of it. I didn't see that. That guy must be drunk or something.
So after you've all the way listened to this episode and gotten to this recommendation part, don't listen to this episode. Watch the movie and then go back and listen to this episode. That makes sense?
Yes.
No, it doesn't. No, I can't necessarily recommend it, but I can't not recommend it. I'm in that weird spot. It is a weird movie. Everything how it's presented is weird, and I think that might be some of its own detriment.
Well, that's one thing we should do is just say, definitely see Pontypool. That's a better movie.
Should you watch it? Watch Pontypool.
And if you like Pontypool, then maybe give this a try. How about
that? Yeah, I mean, that's why I watched it, because I'm exploring more of Tony Burgess's work, and I think Pontypool might just be his amazing, and this might be living. So, on that note, kids, catch you later, John.
See you later, everybody.
Catch you later, everybody.
What the hell's going on?